What if you could have a conversation with a serial killer? Actually sit in a room across the table from them and hear them tell the story of who they are, what they did, and why they did it. What if you could separate their truths from their lies and actually maybe hear something that they've really never told anybody before? From the team that brought you Down the Hill, The Delphi Murders, comes Deviant. It's a show that explores the people who blow through society's boundaries, the people who live beyond the margins. The episodes are released each and every Tuesday and Friday, with Friday stories featuring interviews with people who have spent their lives and their careers close to crime. These include former FBI agents, undercover agents, and crime journalists who have covered the most shocking and high-profile cases. Deviant is available now. You can follow and listen on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or any major streaming platform. Hey, welcome to Drop Dead Serious. I'm Ashley Banfield. Last week, the 911 call from the University of Idaho murders, that was released officially. And it gave us our first real glimpse into the chaos and the horror of that morning. But now some recently filed court documents are revealing something just as critical. What prosecutors actually plan to prove at a trial of Brian Koberger in something called a motion in limine for self-authentication of the records. The prosecution is outlining some key evidence that they intend to present at trial, including surveillance footage, purchasing records of both Brian Koberger and the victims, as well as digital data. But what do these records really tell us? How crucial are they to the prosecution's case? And how will Brian Koberger's attorneys fight back? Those are all really good questions, and Brian Enten is the guy to answer them. He is the national correspondent for News Nation. He's my colleague, and he joins me now to break all of this down. Brian, this is such a treat we do TV together all the time, but this is, we're not limited to 5 minutes now.
I'm always excited anytime I get to talk to you more than 3 minutes on TV.
I know. Me too, yeah. Because there's a big difference between, you know, putting shows together and, you know, making sure everything's produced and there's video and there's graphics and there's lower thirds and there's, you know, commercial breaks, et cetera. And then getting to talk to you about the work that you've done in the field, because those are 24-hour days, you know, that you're out there. They're not 3-minute hits. And to that end, this story, the Idaho story, you lived it. I mean, if there's one reporter who was there from the moment it began, you know, all the way through, all the details, it was really you. And I feel like I have forgotten more than I've been learning in the last year, just because it's been 2.5 years.
Yeah. And there was this silence for so long, you know, with the gag order, and we weren't getting a lot of information for a while. And now information sort of trickling out with the trial coming up. But yeah, I lived it. I mean, I was on your show every night pretty much. And we just, you know, we stayed there for a couple months straight and then went back, felt like every other week for a while, just trying to dig and find information and get to know the victims' families. And it's, you know, like you, it's a case that's really close to my heart.
I remember when you, a couple really poignant moments. You were there when they were taking a lot of the items out of the house, and the way you described it to me off air, and then we had the conversation on air, was so moving. You said, I'm out on the street, you know, and they're in the parking lot. They parked these big trucks and they're bringing out all the kids' belongings, and everybody was like dead silent. And it was eerie. Remind me of that moment that you sort of lived through right there, watching it all happen in front of you.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you know this from covering these cases. When you're day in, day out on the scene, you're so, you know, I'm competitive by nature. I'm trying to get as much information as I can. I'm trying to talk to the authorities every day. And you really get in the zone. And I hate to say it, but there are some days where you're so focused on figuring it out that for a second, you don't think about the realness of it and like really what happened, because I mean, you just have to go into work mode. And then there are these times where you're reminded about what happened and who was affected and just the humanness of it. And that was one of those times I remember standing outside the house and this U-Haul pulled up right there at 1122 King Road where the victims were killed. And it was the police chief, the Moscow police chief driving the U-Haul, which just shows like what a small town it is. And he backed it in. And there were some other officers there with him. And they went in and I've learned now they had told the parents that they wanted to do it themselves. They felt a responsibility to be respectful with all the kids' items. So they backed the U-Haul in and just one by one started bringing these items out that belonged to the victims, you know, to Kaylee, Zanna, Ethan, Maddie. And it was just items like from college that you remembered from when you were in college, you know, like funny things you had on the wall or, you know, there were a lot of like those plastic drawers, you know, I had those in college, like in the dorm room or my first apartment, you know, those little plastic drawers.
You get them at like Container Store, you know, and I think there was a lot of makeup and shoes and golf clubs and
Ethan's golf clubs. And like just each item that they brought out, it was just so sad. I had been in the zone of shouting questions at police and chasing after people. And it was just like you said, it was just one of those moments. Like I just stood there. We didn't talk. We didn't ask any questions. And you could just tell like everybody, the media and then also the police, everybody was just like impacted by it.
These murders have been really kind of overwhelming just in terms of the gripping fascination. You know, you and I cover this all the time. We do true crime, right? There are times when there's far more people killed in a particular night and the circumstances are, you know, vexing. And but this one just, I suppose the randomness of it, the brutality of it, the fact that this is the kind of crime that could hit you and me, right? This isn't, oh, well, those two had a beef and I'll never have that beef, so I'm safe. This is the kind of crime in cold blood, Truman Capote, where you feel like, yeah, I could be a victim of this kind of random, maniacal murderer. So with that, I'm sort of thinking of you standing on the street in front of that parking lot while that, you know, that operation is happening and all the kids' things are coming out of the house. But I'm also thinking that's the same parking lot where the kids were standing when they made that 911 call. And that broke last week and we heard that 911 call. I'm not going to dig into it because we've done a lot of that, but I do want to just get your perspective, your thoughts, how it hit you and what you learned from it or what perspective you gained from listening to that 911 call.
Yeah, I think it was another moment where the emotion of it all hits you. You remember that these are just college kids and it takes you right back to that moment. And you and I spoke about it. You know, you put yourself in their headspace at that time. And instead of trying to look back at it and kind of Monday morning quarterback it back it with all that we know, you think about what they were thinking in that moment when, you know, the young man on the phone, when Ethan's best friend saw his best friend dead. I mean, just awful, you know? And I think one thing that I learned from it is that, you know, there was all these people online and all these people are just so hard on these victims and the roommates, but
oh, it's
saying,
appalling.
What happened?
It's appalling. It's I'm so angry at the haters.
Yeah. And I don't see how I think Ashley, like they just want to, no matter what they just want to stir up debate. It doesn't matter what it is. That's what I tell people. Don't read the comments. No matter what you say, they just want to like poke at you. Yeah. But anyway, I everybody's been questioning, well, why didn't they, you know, when they were texting at 4 a.m., why didn't they call the police then? There was a man in their house. What took so long? Because the 911 call didn't come till right before noon. And I really think from that call, we realized, I don't think they really thought it was like some murder or serious thing.
No, of course not.
I think it's a party house. Yeah. I think they were drunk. I think that they saw weird things in that house before and people coming and going and friends were coming in the middle of the night. And I don't think that it hit them until during that call that something really terrible happened.
And you know what? I'll be honest with you. When I was in college, I lived in a house with nine of us, nine friends. We all had our own bedrooms. It was a huge triple story house. I was in the attic. And I remember there were randos in the house all the time. And I think you're not freaked out by randos in your house, but at 4 a.m, a rando who's dressed all in black with a mask would scare you. Your mind would not go two homicidal maniacs just walked through my house.
Right.
Your mind would go to, who the hell was that? I'm going to really give, you know, my roommate hell tomorrow for letting some DoorDash driver or friend or drug dealer come through the house. You know, that's where your mind would go. But, and it would scare you because you're in your, you know, tiny jammies and it's, you know, it's a girl house. So that's where I have always had my head with Dylan's shock, frozen in shock. It wasn't frozen in shock. There's a murderer. It was frozen in shock. There's some dude in here and I'm in my, you know, my baby doll jammies. And even the texting between Bethany and Dylan is more like, just run down here, run down here. If it's a murderer in the house, it's not run down here. It's lock your door. Let's call 911 right away. They had no idea. They had no idea at 11 the next morning. You could hear in Bethany's voice, she thought, it sounded to me that she thought maybe Xana had OD'd.
Yeah. That's what I think too. And like you, I lived in a party house one year in college and I drank a lot. And so did my friends. And I can think of, I mean, you know, you go to bed really drunk and sending crazy texts and stuff. I mean, you know, I don't think that that's that unusual.
Yeah. They don't know the ways of the world, by the way, at that age. They don't know that Truman Capote's In Cold Blood can happen. That stuff from movies, you know, those haters online have absolutely no clue how to put the real moment in time head on their shoulders and think in that perspective than looking in retrospect to this horror show and trying to assume.
And people read the victims read the comments. I mean, you know that. You talk to them, their families. Mm. They, you know, when you've lost a loved one and you're up all night and you can't sleep because you live in this state of grief, like they go on and they read comments. It's just, they're trying to look for information. You can't help yourself. And it really hurts them. I hope people, it's not a video game.
I wonder how apologetic they'll be after trial. Once they hear the story that these poor girls are going to tell on the stand of what they knew and what happened and what was, putting all the pieces together and filling in all the blanks. You know, when we get the full narrative, I sure hope there'll be as many apologies as there were attacks. Let me move on to the motion in limine, because there's been so much attention paid to the 911 call that this motion in limine, I feel like it sort of slipped under the radar. And holy Dinah, there's some stuff in there. Suddenly I started to see what the prosecution is doing. Because basically, you know, to be simple about it, it's just one of those things that you're trying to basically enter records and documents and make sure that they're authenticated. And that's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. It's saying, here are the records and documents and things that we want to bring into the trial. And they're good to go. They're not AI. They're not fakes, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, in that group is a lot of surveillance video, a lot of purchasing records, a lot of financial records, parking records. And what I thought was so interesting was that it's not just from Brian Koberger. It's from the girls too, the housemates. So I started looking for patterns to see, well, are they trying to put Brian Koberger in the same places that the girls are maybe shopping by lining up his financial records and surveillance records with their day at Marshall's or, you know, at Ross Dress for Less or, you know, in these stores. And that's sort of, I think, where I'm going with a lot of this. But let me start with the Washington State University campus official records. They've pulled the cameras from Washington State University campus. And I think that's really significant because Brian Koberger lived on campus. Even though he was in an apartment, he lived on campus. So walk me through what you think some of those surveillance videos might show and why they might be significant for the 13th before or after November 13th.
Yeah, well, I've been to his apartment several times, and it is an apartment, but it's an on-campus apartment. There's a lot of international students that live there. It was a two-bedroom apartment, I believe, but he had it all to himself. And there are surveillance cameras in that area, so it would make perfect sense that they want to see, you know, when the white Hyundai Elantra was coming and going, especially, you know, connected to the early morning hours of November 13th when the murders happened.
So you would see him coming and going to his apartment.
Yeah.
You'd see him pull out. And to that end, they're pulling parking records too. And I'm thinking, okay, if you're a university student who lives on campus in one of these campus housing apartments, you probably have to pay for parking too. And you probably have an assigned stall. So maybe the parking records also show that this car pulled out and pulled back in 4 hours later.
Or at his office. You know, he had an on-campus office also. It's probably maybe a mile and a half from his apartment. Parking there is tough, though. You know how parking is on college campuses. So that may have also been an area where they're looking into the parking records to see when he came and went from there. His office, I went there too. It was down in the basement of one of the buildings there on campus.
So the other parking record issue, I think, might also be at trial, that they wanted to establish that white Elantra. Everything about it, because it's hinky, right? It had Pennsylvania plates that were switched out to Washington plates just after the murders. And so in looking for all the white Elantras after the murder, they got to figure out, you know, all the white Elantras in that area, they got to find out where they are. And I'll bet you that the Washington State University parking records showed white Elantra over there at the apartment of Brian Koberger. So just again, to get you to the search and to get you to his car, I'm thinking that might be why they wanted the university parking records.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I hadn't thought about that, because there was that, you know, that crazy time where all the only piece of information that they were releasing to us was that it was a white Elantra that they were thought that had a connection to the case. Remember, every night we would be going on with the picture of the Elantra. So you're right. They were probably searching these records in Pullman, where he was living at Washington State, probably in Moscow too, trying to, you know, track down all of the Elantras.
It looks like on November 18th, that'd be just a couple of days after the murder, he registered the car in Washington and he got the license plates on December 5th. And then a couple of days later, a cop actually was searching that database for a white Elantra registered at the school and discovered there it was. There was his car with Pennsylvania plates. But then later, just that same day, another Washington State University cop finds Koberger's car in a Pullman, Washington parking lot, you know, 10 miles from the crime scene. And they said they ran the car and it returned to Koberger with Washington tag. So it may have said in one parking record that it was a Pennsylvania plate, but when they ran it again a few days later, or even that same day, they found that it was indeed, you can run, but you can't hide. You can change the registration on the car, but it's going to show up both ways if you have all the parking records, right?
And this was before, I'm assuming, they traced everything back with the IgG, with the genetic genealogy. This is just when they just had the car at that point.
Yeah, yeah. They hadn't even gotten to the point where they, you know, knew, well, I think they took that little tiny, really tiny speck of genetic material off the snap of the K-bar knife. And they had to send it to Texas to get it extrapolated, to get it built out into, you know, a robust sample so that they could do genetic genealogy. So yeah, this is all when they're trying to just find the car. Let's go to the cell phone data and the digital records. I always get really bored during this part in trials when they get the AT&T guy up there to go over digital records, because it usually takes a day and it's super dry and they just have to authenticate everything. But I think with this guy, with Brian Koberger, I feel like they're going to map his movements, not just on the 12th and 13th, right? Saturday night into Sunday morning of the murder. I think they're going to map his movements for like a year, or at least through like beginning of summer, through summer, all of fall, up until the murders and afterwards.
Let me tell you this. So what's interesting about the cell phone records, and I've realized this with a few trials that I've covered, and then also just knowing defense attorneys who I've spoken to, including my dad, cell phone records are not a perfect science. They can really be an area for the defense where they can poke holes. Experts will explain that it's not like GPS. It's not like GPS on your phone where it's telling them exactly where you are.
Within 10 feet. You can't push someone to a spot within 10 feet with cell phone.
They're trying to triangulate it through the towers, which is not a perfect science. So I'm kind of interested to see how much they try to poke holes in this during the trial, because I could see it being a big area for the defense.
I do think, though, that they're going to be really like strategic about laying it all out. And I hope the jury's like not eating too much at lunch when they get to this point, because after lunch, juries get sleepy a lot of times and then they start zoning out and looking. And when you have technical information, it's really bad to do it then. But, you know, I'm going to skip ahead here to this like traffic stop that that they did with Koberger in August of 2022.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah. A lot of people forget about that. August 21st. Yep.
So
right in Moscow.
It's 11:40 at night. It's late at night, right? a lot of people don't maybe remember this one or forgotten this one, but he, at August 21st, he stopped at 1140 at night by Latah County, the sheriff's there. And he's at the intersection of West Pullman Road and Farm Road in Moscow. And they said, you're not wearing a seatbelt, or at least it's a seatbelt violation, right? And that's all fine and dandy, but he's driving the 2015 white Elantra. It's got the Pennsylvania plates on it. It's got the license plate, LFZ8649. And during this stop, what's critical about it is that he gives his phone number to the cop. And the phone number ends in the digits 8458. And why that's important is because at this moment, he's only 2 miles from the King Roadhouse. It's 1140 at night, August 21st. He is not far from King Roadhouse when he's pulled over and he gives that phone. So then from the probable cause affidavit, August 21st, the 8458 phone used cellular resources providing coverage to the King Road residents. Makes sense. He's close by. And that was from 1034 to 1135 at night. So he is pinging off of towers that service the King Road house for an hour, 1030 to 1130 at night, right? But like just a few minutes later, literally 2 minutes later, when he stopped by those Latah County sheriffs for the seatbelt violation, the 8458 phone is now using the tower that's consistent with Farm Road and Pullman. So I think they're going to say, don't tell us that on that night, the cell phones were all over the map. We got them on another night doing this. We got them on another night pinging in exactly the same pattern. So maybe it isn't such a bad science after all. That's just maybe my read of it. Am I off?
No, I think that's a really good point. I could see them bringing that up. I think it's interesting that the stop was so late at night. It's not far from the King Road address, but there's, I mean, it's a small town. I mean, everything is not really far if you're in Moscow. But it's also where he was pulled over is also very close to the shopping center where they're requesting a lot of the sales transactions also in these documents you're talking about related to the victim. So it makes you wonder why he was right in that area near the shopping center. Again, though, I'll tell you from being there. So you have Moscow with University of Idaho, where the girls, where the victims went, the girls and Ethan. And then you've got Washington State in Pullman, which is just 15 minutes away. But like a lot of the people in Pullman will drive to Moscow for certain stores. Like there might not be, I'm not sure, but there might not be like a PetSmart in Pullman, but there is in Moscow because they're so close together. The mall is better in one of the places. So I don't think it would be unusual for him to be near that shopping center. Granted, I can't imagine those stores would be open that late. I mean, 1140.
Well, not only that, but I think another strategy that I'm seeing in this list, and again, this is just theory, but
yeah,
you know, they've got, I'll show you, like they've got this little map to show you all the local businesses in this area that have been, that are in this motion, eliminate all the surveillance cameras from all these businesses. And we'll pop it up on the screen. If you go around the horn of all the little green dots up in the upper left-hand corner, there's a Petco, there's a Marshalls, there's a Target, there's a Ross, there's a Rite Aid, there's a Joann's Fabrics, there's an Ulta, I think that's Beauty Supply, there's a Winco. And those, all of those are listed. We want your surveillance video. But what's interesting is not just we want your surveillance.
Well, financial records too.
We want financial records too.
Yeah.
And that was super interesting to me. So up on the top left is that little green dots, right? The Winco on the far right of those green dots, the Winco, they wanted financial records and surveillance of Brian Koberger for Winco. For the girls, they wanted the financial records of the girls and then also the surveillance. And I'm thinking maybe they want to prove that he was stalking them. If those line up, like if the surveillance shows him there or his phone data shows him in this area at the same time, say one of the girls is buying something from Joann's Fabrics or Ulta Beauty Supply.
Yeah.
Well, now you're talking, right? How many coincidences can Brian Koberger explain away at trial if he's also seen by records and surveillance as to basically being in the same place as these girls multiple times or even a few times or even one time?
It's a good point. Like I'm looking at the list here. I mean, they're looking for Kaylee's financial records from Petco, from Ross right there. So I guess they could be saying, okay, if we've got evidence that Koberger was there, and then we look back at Kaylee's records and she's buying something around the same time, would that show that they just have, why were they in the same parking lot at the same time before, you know, before the murders? Mm. The only thing I'm thinking back to right now is, remember when the defense did that telephone survey of potential jurors in Moscow, remember?
Yeah, I do.
And remember they had the question that said something about Koberger stalking the victims, knowing the victims before. And it came out when they were fighting about this survey in court. And this is when they were such a gag order and we couldn't get any info, like little nuggets would sneak out. It came out that no, but that question wasn't even good because that's not even true, that he was stalking. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it just makes you wonder, did they never find a connection? Because they were so clear about that in court that day, I remember. Because I had always wondered if he was stalking them based on things. That, remember, I had interviewed the vape shop manager.
Yes.
Who talked about how scared Kaylee was all the time. And she mentioned having a stalker and like living in fear, basically. So it'll be interesting to
see what
comes out.
I see a lot of records in criminal murder trials. And you don't often see the victim's financial records being pulled, you know, and I just kept thinking, well, there's so much that looks like it lines up in terms of Brian's financial records, the victim's financial records, the surveillance videos in these same places. So I just kind of have a feeling that this might be, again, when you're a jury and you hear a defense attorney explain away a bunch of things as like, that's a possible coincidence. Like it could be a coincidence. You can usually be okay with one of those, sometimes even two. But if you start hearing 3, 4, 5, 6 different coincidences, well, now your level of reasonable has kicked in saying, nope, sorry. If he's been chased, and again, this is a theory. If he has been following these girls around to these stores and to these areas, you know, and we can see the data showing that and the surveillance video showing that, and then suddenly they are murdered, and then suddenly his DNA is there, and then suddenly he's arrested, your coincidence level, you know, disappears. You have no tolerance for coincidence anymore.
And why else would they be pulling like Petco?
Right.
I mean, I'm just trying to think of another reason. I can't think of another reason. The only thing I'm wondering too is, are these all things they may have been doing early on and then ruled out? You know what I mean?
Well,
I guess we don't know if they actually made any conclusions.
If I'm the defense attorney, I'm going to say Petco. Okay. You might have to swallow the whole stalking part, right? But let's just say Kaylee walks in with her dog to Petco, and Brian decides to walk in after her because he's keeping an eye on her closely. She doesn't know that this man is watching her. And that might be, again, if you're the defense attorney, that might be a way that that puppy dog's hair got on Brian's clothes. And he brought it back to the apartment. If I'm the defense attorney, that's what I would say. I'd say that about Petco. He's thinking of, you know, adopting a dog, baloney. Again, too many coincidences. And that's how the dog hair, if in fact the animal hair that's talked about in the probable cause affidavit is being found at Brian Koberger's apartment, if that matches Kaylee's dog, that could be an explanation for it. It's pretty sad, though, because you got to give up the fact that you're stalking the murder victim in order to have that dog hair, you know, traced back to your apartment.
Wouldn't that be incredible if that ended up tracing back to Kaylee's dog?
Yeah, Murphy.
I wonder, though,
a dog named Murphy. So cute.
Murphy, yeah.
Little golden
such
doodle.
A cute, like a little doodle. Yeah. I wonder if they would have put that in the probable cause, if they would have done that testing early on, you know.
Nope.
There's so much we don't
they
know.
They don't, because so they just said brown spots. They didn't say blood. You would test it later to find if it's, they call it presumptive,
right.
But they would call it blood later. But they don't put it in the probable cause. They say, you know, inventoried one sheet, one mattress cover with brownish stains, you know. That's typically the language of the early investigation, so that they can keep their, they can hedge everything. And they can't say it. They haven't tested it yet. They got to do that at the lab. So they have to be accurate about it. Okay, so let me move on to Linda Lane, because I'm interested in the two surveillance videos. And again, they're probably Ring doorbell cams that are on Linda Lane. One of them is 1330 Linda Lane. The other one is 1320 Linda Lane. So they're very close together.
Yeah, I'm just looking on my phone again to remember.
Yeah, Linda Lane
where it is.
So if you're staring at the front of the house from the parking lot, I think Linda Lane is over to the left. Am I wrong?
Hold on one second. I'm just looking. I remember. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So you're right. And this is it's a very weird little neighborhood with weird little roads that don't feel like real roads. They feel like lanes.
It really is.
They curve around and they're not grid-like. So it's a little hard to, even if you look at a map right now, since the house has been torn down, it's sort of hard to figure out where's this compared to that. But generally speaking, is it fair to say that the surveillance video, the Ring cam from Linda Lane, it's presumed it caught the white Elantra not only going by multiple times that night, but doing the three-point turn. Even if you're seeing bright headlights and you're not necessarily seeing the white, you know, car, you're seeing that activity at that point.
Yes, and I'm just looking at my map again because there was an apartment building, and I remember talking to the landlord where they got that. Remember that grainy surveillance video of the Hyundai?
Yeah.
That was from an apartment building, but then there was also the Ring camera footage, which we were never able to get our hands on. I don't think that's ever been seen.
I think you're right.
But it would make sense. Yeah. And I remember I talked to the owner of that house too, trying to get the Ring camera footage, and she just wasn't going to give it. You know, the police had said, don't share it. But it would make sense why they would want both, because both have a visual, both look out towards the road.
Kind of a line of sight. Yeah, and it's not the best. I mean, the one that's leaked online, if it's accurate, sure looks accurate. But if it's accurate, it shows headlights and it's hard to make out. Maybe an expert could have zoomed in and seen a white-ish car. But the other one may be the one that we haven't seen may be a heck of a lot better. And it would line up with that exact time and show, those headlights doing the three-point turn. That is definitely this car going through plain as day, the white Elantra. But I am fascinated by these poor neighbors, right? They've been a part of this too. This is in their lives. They know that they're part of this trial. They can't just move away and go back home after university. They're stuck in this horror and they have to be a part of it too. And I feel bad for them. I feel bad for anybody who's, you know, cast into something like this and they never intended to be.
Yeah, that Linda Lane picture you just had up there, that is the complex right there. Yeah. I mean, I got to know a lot of the neighbors. There was one neighbor that we paid to use his Wi-Fi because the cell service was so spotty out there. So we would, you know, get to know them. And yeah, I mean, you can only imagine, like, I mean, this took over their, you know, whole year of their college experience. They're all college kids. And then they had to go through the house being torn down. And it was tough on them for sure.
I still disagree with that. I have to say, look, I'm happy that the house coming down helps people heal, but I don't think the healing is paramount to the justice resolution of this case. You know, I feel like at any point it would be confusing for jurors. It's a very confusing house to start with inside. It was a confusing location outside. I really do think that they should have been able to do a walk and a go see around and in and out of that house.
Yeah. Look, since the beginning, and I've told you this, there's been something very strange. I don't know about strange is the right word, with the University of Idaho. They have wanted to tear down that house since almost immediately after this happened. And we've figured that out through emails and different people we talk to. It is a college town. You know, it's all about the college. It's all about getting the students in there. It's all about the money and the small businesses that connect back to the school. They did not want that house to remain because they didn't like the reminder of what happened. They didn't think it was good for the town. And it's very upsetting to some of the victims' families. So they've just felt like that's been a priority of the university. I mean, how quickly did suddenly the owner of the house gave the house to the University of Idaho? Like, you know, remember that?
Like why didn't the police prevent suddenly, that? You know, they prevented the Linda Lane person from giving her video away, but they wouldn't prevent the homeowner the from giving the house away.
Suddenly the university owned the house where the murders happened. I was like, wait, what is going on? I mean, how does the university now own
think
the
about
house?
That, right? The police prevent the homeowners at Linda Lane from giving video out on loan. But they won't prevent the homeowner of the murder scene from transferring title and giving it away to a public entity. I mean, it is a bit weird.
And why not just wait? I know, you and I have talked about this a lot. Like, why not just wait? I mean, put up a big wall, put up a beautiful hedge, whatever you have to do. Yeah. You know, we've seen it in other cases, the Parkland tragedy. Those kids had to look at that school building for years and years and years and walk by it every day. It stinks. It's sad. But
justice is served. And they do, these ghosties. They just do. They did it in the Murdoch case. They went and they got inspiration. Jurors said they got inspiration when they were at Moselle at that ranch. So it was important. These are important things for jurors to get to the truth, right? Because they are supposed to determine the truth. It's very hard to do that with a 3D model. It's just not the same. Yeah. I have gone through every 3D model of that house. I still am a little confused about distance and the sound around the corner and that sort of thing, you know? I think it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a weird house with the three stories.
Yep. All right, so let's talk weather, because I hadn't thought about this. That crazy alibi, you know, whenever that came out months ago about Brian Koberger saying, I guess I can't fight the fact that I left my house. You know, my phone is seen leaving my house at 4 a.m. and suddenly it's turned off and then it's coming back a few hours later and it's turned back on. Can't fight that. How am I going to explain it? And so through his attorney, he suggested the alibi was that he was out stargazing that night, that he does that at night. He drives around at night and he was stargazing. So I pulled the weather. Why did they do that? Why didn't they pull the weather before they chose that alibi? Okay. So Brian, presumably if you're going to go stargazing at 4 a.m, you're going to have thought the night before, hey, it's a nice night. Or maybe a few hours before. Oh, it's a nice night. But no, from 1:30 in the morning on, it is cloudy. And then from the time of the murders, 3:53 a.m., cloudy. 4:17 a.m., cloudy. 4:53 a.m., cloudy. 5:53 a.m., cloudy. 6:53 a.m., cloudy. 7:53 a.m., cloudy. 8:25 a.m., cloudy. And that goes on all the way to 10:53 a.m., where we're about an hour away from the 911 call at this point. And then it's haze. And there's three entries of haze until it returns to being cloudy again. And it is cloudy all the way through until the next night at 1 a.m. So it was socked in Pullman and Washington, in Moscow, Idaho, all the way through this alibi. It's a bit stunning, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think when that alibi came out, everyone was just sort of like, wait, what? Stargazing? You know? And now to hear about the weather, I'm not really surprised. I'm wondering, do you think that's really going to come up at trial?
I do.
Do you think they're really going to try?
You betcha. I'll tell you why. Yeah. Because again, total nerd going through this motion in limine, I noticed another entry that I'm like, National Weather Service records for November 12th and 13th. 2022. So yeah, they have pulled the National Weather Service records for the day before. That's Saturday, November 22nd, and all of Sunday, the 13th. Excuse me, November 12th, 2022, and November 13th, 2022. So they are going to basically say at trial, National Weather Service experts, it's cloudy all day Saturday, right? Yep, cloudy. It's cloudy all Saturday night too, right? Yep. Cloudy right until around 4 a.m. on Sunday? Yep. And how about 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 8 a.m.? Yep. Cloudy all the way through. So would this be the ultimate stargazing weather? Would you be able to see the stars? Socked in, sir. Nope. That's going to be very powerful. I don't know how Ann Taylor's going to fight that.
I don't know that jurors were really going to buy that he just happened to be stargazing out near. I mean,
that's right, because you're a reasonable man, Brandon.
Even if it was a clear night, I mean, that one to me was always like, you know, was kind of like, really? That's the best you got?
That's all you got?
Remember we were like, that's the alibi?
And you turn your phone off? Like, you turn your phone off to go stargazing? Like, for whatever reason, you find it important as you're walking out to your car and driving, because his phone is on while he's driving out of Pullman and then he shuts it off. You need to shut your phone off to go stargazing, and then you need to turn your phone again on when you're driving back into your parking lot hours later?
It kind of goes back to this recent thing that came out that, you know, with their new possible defense that the knife sheath that has his DNA on it, but that someone else may have planted it in the house. Kind of the same kind of feeling that I get, just like, wait a minute, let me try to play this out in my mind. Like, how would, you know what I mean? And I guess they're just trying to put doubt out there.
Sure. But again,
I don't know.
It's the same thing as all the coinkydinks that I was mentioning before. One time there could be something that's unusual that happened, right? Yeah. I went out stargazing and I do turn my phone off. I want dead silence. I just want me in nature. And I don't want my girlfriend or my boyfriend to find me, right? So I turned off my, so one time, yeah. Okay. Maybe that is reasonable. But if you need to line up all these, are you kidding me's all next to each other? That's when your FU reasonable factor kicks in. Stop taking me for a dummy. How many of these things are you expecting me to eat? How many of these silly stories that, you know, you're sounding crazy that you want me to swallow? That's where the juror's gut and their reasonable, radar has to be in tune, because you'll only take one or two of those and you'll say, sure, benefit of the doubt. Okay. But you can't give more than three or four benefits of the doubt or you say bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of why I wonder a lot of this stuff that they've thrown out, it's going to be such a fascinating trial, actually. Like, how are they going to narrow it all down? We don't really know what they're going to do. You know what I mean? How they're going to narrow, even all of this information, like, we know this is all evidence that they have and that they're interested in, but we don't know the little web that they're going to, paint. Like, I think it's going to be such an interesting trial.
I have confidence. I didn't have confidence at the beginning, because when you interviewed, and hats off to you, Brian Enten, you interviewed the prosecutor right in the very beginning. Bill, what's his name again?
Yeah.
Bill
Taylor.
Yeah, Bill Taylor.
Yeah.
Here he is, William. Bill Thompson.
Thompson.
William Thompson Jr. He's on the motion in limine. I thought, what's he doing? What is that prosecutor doing? And he made some mistakes in the stuff that he said to you.
It was bad.
Right? Yeah. It was. I thought, whoa, Keystone.
Well, when I say bad, it wasn't so bad what he said. I think it was a bad situation because he did the interview. And remember at that time, there was this whole time that we forget about before Koberger was arrested, when there was like panic at this time. I mean, yeah, I was even nervous in my hotel room. And I didn't want to sleep on the ground floor. Like, we didn't know who did this, And, he's obviously still innocent until proven guilty. But anyway, when we interviewed Bill Taylor, the big question then was about Bill Thompson. Yeah.
And Taylor, Bill Thompson. I get him mixed up.
Yeah, that's why I keep saying it. Yeah. But when we interviewed Bill Thompson, the big question then was about whether or not the girls were targeted.
Yeah.
And the police chief was saying that they weren't. And then we interviewed Bill and he said that they were, or I think it was the opposite, but anyway.
Oh, Brian, hold on. They also said nothing to worry about in the community. There's no danger to the community.
Correct.
And
were trying to keep everybody calm.
But looking back on it now, like, are you kidding me? No danger to the community. That man wandered for 2 months among our daughters and our sons.
Yeah.
And that was the most dangerous person in our flock on this earth. The man that can, if he's guilty, kill four completely innocent people in their beds.
Correct. And so anyway, so Thompson went against what was sort of the narrative that the police were trying to put out at the time to keep everybody calm. And so we, of course, put Thompson on TV with what he said. And then the police, I don't know if you remember this, the police were not happy and wanted to put out this press release about me making a mistake, saying that I made a mistake. And I said, but we just played the interview that the prosecutor said.
It wasn't my fault.
I was like, did you go back and watch it didn't come out of my mouth, And it was just one of those, because, you're trying to keep everybody sort of on your team because you're trying to get information from the police and you're trying to get information from the prosecutor. And it was just one of those oh my gosh, I've gotten myself into a situation here.
It was crazy. I remember thinking I got it, right? Moscow's a small, lovely university town. They don't get a lot of this kind of crime. They barely had a murder there. I mean, I don't even think they prosecuted many murders in that town.
No.
And so I saw he was a bit in over his head at the beginning. I think they've pulled it together though. I mean, the things that I've been seeing thus far, I mean, under the gag, it's been hard to see anything, seem to be pretty damn clever. And if they are in fact lining up purchasing records of the victims, and if they can line them up with stalking activity of Brian Koberger before the murders, it is game, set, match. I mean, once again, don't ask me to swallow too many of these coincidences, because once you're past, one or two, forget it. So the other one I wanted to ask you about, I still can't understand this one. I don't know if you're going to be able to get it. In the motion, they are asking for surveillance video from, and again, I'm not sure if they made a mistake or if it's just, you know, shorthand, Indian Mountain Lake. Indian Mountain Lake. I'm looking all over for Indian Mountain Lake. I find an Indian mountain.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, I find an Indian mountain.
And records too, surveillance and records.
Yeah. And so I find an Indian mountain that straddles the Washington and Idaho border where I'm like, Eureka, that's it. That must be it. But look how long that line is. It's like a 4.5 hour drive or like somewhere around a 4 hour drive to get up to Indian Mountain. He didn't do that. He didn't have time to get all the way up there and back. He didn't drive 8 hours and get home. If this is Brian Koberger, an Indian Mountain where there are lakes, they're just not called Indian Mountain Lakes. It's called Indian Mountain Lookout. If he drove up there and got rid of the murder weapon and bloody clothes, this was too far. He couldn't have gotten all the way up to Indian Mountain Lookout with its lakes and thrown a bloody knife and bloody clothing up there. So then I'm like, okay, well, there's an Indian mountain, right? That's the 3.5 hour drive. There's an Indian lake. Indian Lake is in the Blue Mountains of Oregon. That's 2.5 hours away. Still too far. That's 5 hours of driving. If you go all the way to Indian Lake, 2.5 hours, you're driving 2.5 hours back. That's 5 hours. He's only gone for the short period of time, right? How many hours was it by the time he had left his apartment and driven back? I think it's like a couple of hours, 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not many. Yeah. It's not many. It's not enough to do these drives. So it's not, it can't be Indian Mountain Lookout 3.5 hours away. It can't be Indian Lake, which is 2.5 hours away. There are no places called Indian Mountain or Indian Lake within an hour or so drive of Moscow.
Well, it's interesting. They don't give the date on that one. Some of these other ones, they give the specific date that they're looking for the surveillance video. There's no date there. A big mystery has been where the knife is.
But I saw some chatter. I saw some chatter that the parents live in a gated area in Pennsylvania that is called Indian Lakes or Indian Mountain Lakes, maybe. That, do you remember any of the signage around
that
area?
I've been in their neighborhood. I'm trying to remember. I'd have to look it up. It is a gated neighborhood.
It just feels
weird.
I mean,
that could make perfect sense.
It could.
But you know what? I was just Googling it and Poconos came out, which is where that is where the parents live.
It's where they live.
Indian Mountain.
So maybe.
Lake. So that could be a possibility for sure.
That could be it. Maybe they wanted surveillance. Maybe.
And there is a guard gate. And there's a guard gate at the parents' development with a guard and a surveillance camera.
Yes.
So that's probably what it is.
Well, maybe what they want here, and this is theory only. I don't know anything to be true yet. Maybe they wanted to see Brian Koberger driving in the middle of the night to throw things away, but I can't imagine for a hot minute Brian Koberger, if he's guilty, keeping all that stuff for 2 months in his apartment or in his car, all the bloody clothes, bloody knife, all the murder detritus. I can't imagine him keeping it and driving all the way across the country with his dad with that in the car, only to throw it out in Pennsylvania. Look, people have done crazy things, but that sounds way too dangerous.
Yeah, he seems too smart for that with his criminology background. But again, there's no date there. So we don't know when. If it is the parents' neighborhood that they were looking for surveillance and records, by the way, the records thing is interesting because there's that guard gate outside the parents. You know, there might be some kind of records. They might have a license plate reader that keeps, you know what I mean? Something like the guard might keep records of who's going in and out. So I bet it is the parents. I think you're right there. Maybe it's, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's from a different date that we're not thinking of. For some reason, they want to see if who was coming in and out.
Maybe. And maybe it is something that maybe he did do a big, long drive a few days later, 5 days after the killings, you know, and he spotted up there in Indian Mountain Lookout where there are lakes 3.5 hours away. And maybe that's where they're going to say, we never found the knife. We never found the bloody clothes. But here we found this particular, you know, suspect, defendant, making a very unusual drive to a very remote place.
Yeah. You know?
Maybe that's what it is.
But the fact that that's the parents' development and it says records too, I don't know. I'm leaning towards it being the parents' house for some reason.
Okay. Well, we'll have to lay odds when we get to trial time to get this mystery solved. Yeah. So many more mysteries too. You'll have to do this again with me the next time we get a document dump, because I tend to think that the puzzle pieces are going to all start falling one by one by one as we get closer to trial.
Yeah, and you did such a good job. That's the thing with these document dumps that are coming now is you really have to look through them closely, because there are little nuggets in these 30, 40 page documents coming out that end up being really important.
And patterns. The patterns.
And patterns, yeah.
That's what I was looking at. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. You want Kaylee's Petco and Joanne's Fabrics and all that. You want her financial records, but you want the surveillance records, and you want Koberger's financial records from that same area.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm starting to see maybe you want to show him as a stalker. And, you know, weeks and months before the killings, how do you explain that? How do you explain that? Maybe that's what they're doing. Again, this is all theory, not to be proven, but my goodness, there's nobody better to go over this stuff with than you, because you keep me honest.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you, Ashley.
Thanks for doing.
You always
this.
Have the best theories. You are the most detail or one of the most detail oriented people I know. Like, nothing escapes you.
I read the footnotes.
I mean, you really do. It's unbelievable. Like, there is no one better to go through these kinds of documents than you.
I swear to God, I have always said that to anybody I'm ever mentoring. I read the footnotes. Never skip the footnotes. The best stuff is in the footnotes at all times.
I believe it.
Thank you for doing this, Brian. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ash.
That's it for this episode of Drop Dead Serious. A big thank you to Brian Enten for joining me and for breaking down the latest developments in the Idaho student murders case. If you're following this case closely, please make sure that you subscribe so that you don't miss any updates or those bonus episodes, because I'm dropping those all the time, super random. I'm going to be covering every major move leading up to the trial. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and then rate the podcast and give me a review, even if it's crapola. I really appreciate hearing from you. I do better when you tell me what I'm doing right and wrong. And if you want to keep the conversation going, I invite you to follow me on social media. You can comment as well on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube. You can share your thoughts. I always love to hear that. Also, tell me what you want me to cover and what you don't want me to cover. I want to know what stood out to you in this latest filing in the Idaho case as well. What questions do you still have? Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, please remember that the truth isn't just serious, it's drop dead serious.